Today's episode of Off Baseline is brought to you by Symbolic Interactionism. When you need to construct a sense of meaning and understanding of the world around us through shared experience of symbols and language, try Symbolic Interactionism. Off Baseline is also underwritten by ADHD. You can tell me a lot of things like, "Hi, my name is CJ," or whatever. But there are shinier, you know, more important things to think about when you're telling them to me, like how immigrants are gross.
Here tonight is one leader in the effort to defend our country. Homeland Security Investigation Special Agent Celestino Martinez. He goes by DJ and CJ. He said, call me either one. So we'll call you CJ.
That's Balkan Beats by the Freak Fandango Orchestra. I'm Nate Staley, and welcome to Off Baseline. Today on the show, I have a pretty interesting conversation with social media professional and instructor of communication at Southwest Baptist University, Becca Godsey. We discuss what we can learn about our communication by our social media presence and how it's in large part helped kind of become an extension of our identities. Also on the show, baseball's Cleveland Indians are officially retiring Chief Wahoo in 2018. How does a culture go from finding symbols like that acceptable to widely rejecting it and pushing for change? We'll put on our non-culturally appropriated thinking caps and dive deep into that. Abominable YouTube personality Logan Paul is happy to be alive and ready for a rebrand, this time with a brain. But first, the State of the Union, Trump's first official State of the Union. He made that, was it Tuesday, a few days ago. It was pretty much what generally you could expect, to think that Trump could, for a short period of time, sort of present himself as a average Republican giving an average Republican address. If you can medicate someone and put, you know, enough practice in place, then he can appear that way. So Tuesday night was officially the day Trump became president. So basically, a large part of his speech, from what I could tell, was a lot of tropes, a lot of nicisms, a lot of just catchy phrases, which is pretty similar to a lot of these speeches in the past. One thing that was pretty noticeably different was about, it seemed like every 5 minutes, maybe less, he was doing something that Ronald Reagan started doing when he did State of the Union addresses, is he would pick someone. Typically, it would be like a military guy, you know, someone he could just point to and he'd start addressing this person. And he'd say, you know, Sergeant Daniels was a four-time, you know, he's done four tours of duty in Iraq, but he wouldn't say Iraq. He would say maybe, you know, Vietnam or something. But he'd point out someone and he'd say, this is why my policy agenda is, you know, important and blah, blah, blah. And so he'd basically use the person as a prop. And we all clap because you don't want to not clap a soldier because everyone is bigly patriotic. So Trump did a lot of that. But he took a twist that we might have seen coming, but it's still kind of gross that he did go that direction. Immigration has been the kind of laser focus of this administration, and I'll just go ahead and play a clip of one of the things he did, one of the families that he pointed out. You can just kind of hear for yourself what he does with it.
They are two teenage daughters. Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens were close friends on Long Island. But in September 2016, on the eve of Nisa's 16th birthday, such a happy time it should have been, neither of them came home. These two precious girls were brutally murdered while walking together in their hometown. Six members of the savage MS-13 gang have been charged with Kayla and Nisa's murders. Many of these gang members took advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as illegal, unaccompanied, alien minors and wound up in Kayla and Nisa's high school.
He's talking specifically about DACA here.
Evelyn, Elizabeth, Freddie, and Robert, tonight everyone in this chamber is praying for you. Everyone in America is grieving for you. Please stand. Thank you very much.
So he's using this tragedy to push basically opposition to DACA and immigration in general, really. It's kind of a first. Not kind of. It's definitely a first. I mean, we could look that up later, point it out. I'd be happy to hear feedback, but not aware of that. And you can hear this clapping, right? This loud clapping. That's kind of a first. The president sort of clapping right into the microphone, which, you know, it's wonderful to hear.
I want you to know that 320 million hearts are right now breaking for you. We love you. Thank you.
So just really just using that, just playing it up, the tragedy that family went through, using that as an excuse to basically drum up opposition to immigration in general, tying it to gang activity, you know, doing the whole MS-13 thing, using that as sort of a, you know, sort of a scare tactic. And so he's drumming up this perception of immigrants as criminals. And when you do that, the trope is always, I am against illegal immigration and I'm for legal immigration. But the more you sort of do these tie-ins, you basically start to make the connection of immigration and gangs. And there's very little sort of nuance there to sort of differentiate between legal and illegal. It's just, what kinds of people do I want, if any, coming into the country? And it really kind of gets into, I don't want immigration, or at least I don't want immigration that makes me feel unsafe based on what I've been told. But you understand sort of what this is and what we're doing here. It's getting pretty dangerously fairly close to textbook neo-fascism or post-World War II fascism. Just a component of that, a feature of that being just generally anti-immigrant and generally trying to turn the public opinion into just opposing immigration in general, so you can push a certain policy perspective. And that seems to be laid on pretty thick here. So we'll go ahead and play another piece of that. Some more interesting, a big chunk of this, kind of the big middle chunk of this speech was immigration stuff. So let's hear some more made up stuff.
The fourth and final pillar protects the nuclear family by ending chain migration.
Chain migration, also known, actually it's only been known as,
under the current broken system,
family immigration.
A single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children.
Okay. So I'm just going to read you guys something. This is something that's been floated around on the internet as kind of a proposal to sort of, reach across the aisle and maybe make a compromise. Okay, I'm going to read it to you guys. Are you ready? Here is a proposed compromise on ending chain migration in return for a DREAM Act. And this was posted on Twitter. I can't remember if it was something he wrote. This is an immigration lawyer. His name is Stephen Robbins. So I don't know if this is something he wrote or if this is something he's reposting, but this is his proposed compromise on ending chain migration. Okay, you guys ready for it? First point, there's four pillars. First pillar, U.S. citizens may only sponsor parents, spouses, children, and siblings. No grandparents, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, no nephews, no nieces. And green card holders may only sponsor spouses and children. All right, that's giving up a lot there. That's, you might have relationships with all these different family members. Well, if you want to immigrate here, then you're going to have to just give up a lot of those things. Okay. Second pillar, I'm switching between the two. Sponsors must show that they have enough money to support their family member and must reimburse the federal government if the family member takes welfare. Okay. So pay your own way. You know what? Shucks. Why are you costing us so much money? That's ridiculous. Third point/pillar. No immigrant shall be eligible for government assistance for at least 5 years. That's right. We don't want someone just showing up and taking all this free stuff. None of it's, I have to work. So why shouldn't you? Why should it all just be free and you just get it right away? So make him wait 5 years just to make him wait, because you got to learn somehow. Okay. I mean, this is tough. This is a big compromise. And then pillar 4.4, all immigrants shall pass screening for criminal convictions, health, and good moral character before getting residency. Good moral character. Now that's what we want to hear, right? No criminal convictions. Yeah, they're sending drugs. They're sending their worst. They're not sending their best. So this is going to solve all that, right? This is it. So, I can't believe this hasn't been on the books in the past. Before getting residency, we're going to make sure you're just a good moral person and no criminal convictions in your history. Okay, pretty strict, Sometimes we can reform people, but no, not if you're an immigrant. We're not gonna reform you. We're not gonna do that. We're only gonna take your best, okay? So those are the 4 points. Does that sound pretty fair and reasonable to you guys? Well, that's great if it does, because I've got some good news actually. That's actually the law. That's already the law of family immigration. That's policy that all immigrants already go through. So there you go. Chain migration. What a term, right? There's some real sort of implications or things that conjures up when you use a term sort of aggressive sounding like chain, like a chain of just people that you have no idea. It was created. That's a created term that has nothing to do with the actual policy of family immigration policy. So that's all already law. So I don't know what we're suggesting here, unless we just want to get rid of immigration in general. These are pretty strict laws already on the books. So let's figure out what we want. Was talking in the last episode, what are our values? What do we value as a society? How does that relate to immigration? and what is actually different from the law. So we have the president doing a lot of that. I think he also did a quote. He said, "Americans are dreamers too," which is basically, you know, it's kind of this. It's kind of a big F you to the dreamers. Let's cover something. Maybe he said something nice. Maybe Trump said something nice in his speech. Let's look at that. Let's listen to this clip.
"These reforms will also support our response to the terrible crisis of opioid and drug addiction. Never before has it been like it is now. It is
addiction.
Terrible. We have to do something about it. In 2016, we lost 64,000 Americans to drug overdoses, 174 deaths per day, 7 per hour. We must get much tougher on drug dealers and pushers if we are going to succeed in stopping this scourge."
There you go. There you go. Yeah, that's something we can just, I can buy into. All right, great. That's great. Shallow, empty rhetoric without any policy proposal attached to it. But that sounds a lot nicer than immigrants are criminals and here are the victims, so you can look at them in the face and realize how scared you should be. No, the problem of opioid addiction is a, addiction too. Both problems are a big, that's something someone should be talking about in a State of the Union address, laying out your plan, laying out how you're going to improve society. That's great. Didn't give us any specifics, so I'm pretty skeptical when there are no specifics, especially when we're talking about addictions and mental health. We hear a lot of mental health brought up with absolutely no substance to it whatsoever, and it's becoming pretty comical when it does happen just constantly, especially with gun debates or anything like that. Mental health, we need to talk about mental health. Well, of course we do. But like, what are you going to do? Who's going to pay for it? What are we proposing? What are we going to do differently? How are we going to talk about it? But you know, let's just not put the cart before the horse here. Let's not get to, let's just focus on the fact that Trump said a nice thing, and that's nice. So there's this guy, he's the quintessential, turns out, reason for trauma-informed education and culture change initiatives. This guy, Logan Paul, he's, before the story, I'm not a big YouTube personality guy, being up on that. Before the story, I'd not heard about him. I didn't know who he was. He's a YouTube personality. I can't quite seem to understand the value-added perspective. He decided to sort of wallop around Japan, and I guess he was flopping raw fish in people's faces. He threw pokeballs at the police, just being a general a-hole, which people will watch, sure. It blew up for him when he was the part of the video blog he was doing where he waltzed into in Japan was what's kind of referred to as a suicide forest. And forgive me for pronunciation. I have no sort of background in learning how to pronounce Aokigahara. Okay, I'm lying. I have some background in pronouncing Japanese names. I watched the Mariners growing up, and so I can pronounce Ichiro Suzuki. So Aokigahara is a forest. It lies sort of at the base of Mount Fuji, and it's a place with a lot of mythology surrounding death. He basically, in the video, he exploited a lifeless body of someone who had completed suicide by hanging, from a tree. For clicks, that would, of course, come from the shock of the video. He took time. He did this. Again, I'm not sure why this guy was famous in the first place, but that's just, I'm a cranky old millennial. But he did this interview. He's been trying to rebrand and sort of say, I learned, I'm a better person, I think is what he's going for. The Michael Strahan on ABC, and you can kind of tell, I'm not sure. I'll play just a brief clip of that, but we'll see.
100 yards away from the parking lot. It doesn't make any sense. And I believe it happened for a reason. And I think that reason is so I could take this experience, learn from it, spread the message the right way mm-hmm. about suicide prevention and suicide prevention awareness.
So he's kind of turning that around and sort of saying, well, this guy's suicide that I walked up on and then just made a goofy video about, it happened so that I could learn not to exploit that for YouTube monetization. And so now I believe in getting the word out about suicide prevention. You know what? As far as mental health goes, we'll take imperfect allies. I don't have any particularly kind of respect, you know, for what his YouTube page offers. I'm sure broad majority of his followers would probably not care what I would have to say about things, but that's just the way it is. But if he's reformed now and he's going around and saying, you know, be aware of suicide. He kind of talked later about, oh, I'm going and I'm doing this initiative now and I'm hugging people who tell me their stories and whatever. That's fine. It's kind of an interesting commentary on sort of, there's a lot of YouTube content out there that's, I never really understood, and I think a lot of parents and older generations don't really understand sort of what is kind of going on, but just goofy videos that people do for a living, and sometimes, and the barrier to entry is so different from what it used to be. It used to be you had to have all the certain qualifications or some kind of something. You had to be somewhat knowledgeable, maybe not always, but generally speaking, but that barrier to entry is kind of taken down by YouTube. So it's got positives and it's got negatives, and people that can just make goofy videos about just being a bro just around the world or whatever, you can gain a platform and a voice from that and make some money from that. And so that happens. And so occasionally they interact with serious topics like this. And it's not entirely surprising that there's some immaturity if the person was immature in other ways. If he was throwing pokeballs at people in Japan, big shocker, he wasn't the most trauma-informed individual or culturally, aware personality. So, you know, again, we'll try to take a little bit of grace on this and just say, imperfect allies, if you want to be generally just, okay, supportive of people who are going through suicide, contemplating suicide, going through suicidal thoughts, I should say. Feel free to talk about it with them. Mentioning suicide specifically has actually been statistically proven. When you're concerned about someone and you bring it up, it's been proven to actually decrease the chance. A lot of people have had this sort of old tale that it increases suicide or puts an idea in their head or something. Well, that's not the case. Bring it up. If you're concerned that someone's considering it, directly talk to them, say, obviously kind of do it in a way that's appropriate based on the relationship that you guys have, but just be direct about it. Say, ask them if they're considering taking their life, if they're considering killing themselves or attempting suicide. Be supportive of that and contact if you need to sort of agree to maybe take some steps if they are sort of going in that direction, if they have access to weapons or means to suicide, be aware of that and sort of try to get in contact with the mental health professional and talk about limiting that access for a short period of time. Offer your concern and be available and be assertive. It's not a bad thing. I know we hate to interject ourselves in people's lives, especially depending on the personality, but just do it. It's worth sort of being out of character or being uncomfortable or making them feel uncomfortable for a little while, because largely speaking, they're going to appreciate the fact that you interjected and sort of asserted yourself and maybe were a little overbearing for a little while to save their life. And the suicide prevention hotline number is, if you're considering suicide, call 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Talk to someone, contact a mental health professional, call the suicide prevention hotline. Just get help. I mean, we all are here and we're all imperfect. there's a lot of imperfection, but suicide is a thing that ideation, the thoughts, the suicidal thoughts, the feeling like suicide is an option is something that lasts for a little while. But it's not permanent. And if you can see past that, then you have an opportunity to sort of try things new. You know, we'll take it, Logan Paul. All right, I hope you're reformed now and you don't do any of those goofy... You will, never mind. But just don't be an ass about suicide. So, as you guys may or may not be, probably not, well, maybe... Because I consider most of my audience at this point to be friends, maybe a couple family members, but I'm a pretty big baseball fan. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I am a Seattle sports fan, but a Seattle Mariners fan. And so a lot of depression if I allow that to my team's success to be an indicator of that. The Cleveland Indians have long had a caricature, a racially based caricature. I mean, even just starting with the name Indians being kind of embarrassingly inaccurate. But the logo that they've had, Chief Wahoo, is a sort of, he's got big teeth and just kind of exaggerated, red-faced, just... what would widely be considered as sort of an offensive caricature of Native Americans. Well, this year, the Cleveland Indians are beginning to withdraw that and kind of do away with the logo, instead opting for a Block C logo. I'll just read the statement from MLB that I'm drawing from an ESPN article. Major League Baseball is committed to building a culture of diversity and inclusion throughout the game, Commissioner Manfred said in a statement. Over the past year, we encouraged dialogue with the Indians organization about the club's use of the Chief Wahoo logo. During our constructive conversations, Paul Dolan, who is the Indians owner, I believe, made clear that there are fans who have long-standing attachment to the logo and its place in the history of the team. Nonetheless, the club ultimately agreed with my position that the logo is no longer appropriate for our on-field use in Major League Baseball. And I appreciate Mr. Dolan's acknowledgement that removing it from the on-field uniform by the start of the 2019 season is the right course. So we kind of learned there that it's more the 2019 season that they're that they are doing away with it and they're just sort of phasing it out. But kind of my just personally, my initial take is that if this is causing distress for you, then you probably have a decent life. But just a couple of thoughts. I mean, this can sort of delve, and I'm sure in the crevices and the caverns of AM talk radio, sports talk radio, there are a lot of offended white dudes out there that are just not going to have this. But I'll just kind of approach this from a sociological perspective, a social science perspective. Kind of think a couple of terms come to mind. One is cultural appropriation. This is kind of a textbook application. Having a sports team with a logo that is just obviously exaggerating and caricaturing Native American culture in this very sort of shallow and just this sort of inaccurate white man's perception of some kind of unruly character. Cultural appropriation is a concept dealing kind of with the adoption of elements of a minority culture by members of the dominant sort of majority culture. So it's kind of a function of colonialism, of, you know, the power in charge sort of using elements of that just because they can, because they are on the other side of the imbalance of power, and they can sort of just appropriate that in ways that are sort of stealing from the heritage of the minority culture being appropriated, and just kind of borrowing whatever sort of symbol or cultural element or ritual or practice for kind of generating or colonializing and creating your own sort of thing without any reference, or, you know, it's kind of like a cultural plagiarism. So that's the obvious thing that kind of comes to mind, and that's a textbook example. But then we also kind of get to our sponsor for the day, the symbolic interactionism perspective in sociology, that we construct a sense of meaning and understand the world around us through shared experiences of symbols and language. Meanings are formed based on social interactions. So for proponents of this logo, fans against the change, the meaning of the Chief Wahoo logo is developed based on childhood memories of teams they enjoyed watching, a sense of community, everyone in your life treating that logo in such a high esteem and regard, and there's fun involved, and then there's a sort of protective element of anyone who complains about it as just being whiny, PC, liberal, whatever. It's likely that this sort of perspective is developed without, as we have sort of oftentimes we follow the same circles. And it's unlikely that a lot of Native American people are kind of involved in this sort of formulation of this perspective. So that's kind of why people just sort of grow up with it, and they look at it as it's not a big deal. It's just fun. It's just baseball. But then you get to a broader societal and American history perspective, and we want to sort of add layers of perspective and understanding as we look at this, or at least if you are watching or listening to this podcast, that's what the goal is. And so you can't touch if you kind of look at it from that broader perspective, you can't touch any aspect, any grain of dirt or sand or rock or part of land that isn't connected with colonialism, that wasn't affected by the past, of the violence of manifest destiny, of the attitude of empire expansion. If you grew up, if you grew up in an average American life, you think, well, most people that I know are pretty nice. Baseball's fun. The Cleveland Indians are fun. The 95 team was really good. The 2016 team was really good. But not better than the Cubs. But, so this image is about all that stuff and not what's in the past, you know, is kind of the thought process there. And on the other hand, with that history, kind of being said, if you're native born, or if you're experiencing even empathy for some of these realities in the sort of violent, genocidal, colonial, tame the inferior savages attitudes that led to this nation state existing and becoming the most powerful and wealthy military empire on the planet, that's just, if we're being honest, that's what happened. And maybe you sort of learned in school differently, whether you had a private education that or even a public education. This is played down a lot because America's awesome, is, you know. And so to kind of have all this and then sort of not learn about it kind of can skew your perspective. But if you have empathy, the meaning, and you have this knowledge, the meaning that you develop around the Chief Wahoo logo, you start to see the big tooth, the red face, the caricature, the exaggerated features. And you start to realize and understand that this is a continued extension of that legacy of violence. And as you sort of realize that, minds change and public opinions change. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's the positive here. That's the thing to be celebrated. It's not about ruining everyone's fun or ruining your childhood or piling on guilt for you, personal guilt. That's not what this is about. It's about empathy. And so as we sort of realize that, we can create a society, or we can at least move towards a society that acknowledges and is honest with its past, is acknowledging and is honest with bad things we've done. And sure, maybe your parents did that more than you did. Maybe your grandparents or your great grandparents are more responsible as far as generationally speaking. And yeah, okay. But are you going to learn from that? Are you going to learn from this legacy? And are you going to take these lessons and apply them to the problems of today, of the imbalances and injustices of today, and do your small part in not maintaining the oppression of people? It's not really asking a lot to be sensitive of something that really is damaging or dehumanizing to someone else. That's the least we can do as people coming from, and I'm going to use a bad word here, coming from privilege. I want to give a brief shout out to my brother Jason for taking on a supportive producer role in this podcast. He's helping me put some of these videos up on YouTube and making them as presentable as one can. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate that all of you that have listened so far. I'm obviously still figuring this out, but I'm finding it to be a lot of fun. I think there's a lot of good stuff being talked about. And thanks for listening. And I hope more people listen. But if you're listening now, I hope you come back and keep it up. So that said, we've got a pretty good pretty good interview for this episode. So quick musical interlude. We'll be back with Becca Godsey to talk about social media and communication.
I got to know, have you seen a hazel? Last time I saw her, she was working tables at the corner bar, right across from the old church. She's so sweet, like lemonade on her front porch. And Hazel, and Hazel, and
just a brief programming note. I would like to apologize. Due to an unforeseen error with the audio and losing a portion of that, I had to use some of my backup audio for this interview, which has a lot of room noise and just a lot of janky adjustments. So enjoy the interview.
Joining me on Off Baseline is a communications instructor at Southwest Baptist University, and she also works as a social media lead. Becca Godsey, welcome to Off Baseline.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. I'm glad you're excited because we're just trying to get the show off off the ground and definitely need excitement to do that. I guess I don't really know what it takes, but I'm guessing it's excitement.
But, you'll find out. Yeah. Or if you don't, this will be a short podcast.
Right, right. Either way. And I'm fully prepared either way. You know, I always tell, I didn't say it this time, but I always say, it could be anywhere from, 10 to minutes to an hour. I don't know. we'll
somewhere.
See if we get tired of talking about what the topic is at hand. But
it's a reasonable time frame.
Yeah, I try to be pretty flexible, and that's literally, it could take, however many minutes we feel like taking. So,
yeah.
I appreciate you being on here. And because of the nature of the field that you do kind of instructing in, you teach in, and the social media work that you do, I thought you would be a pretty good guest to sort of go into. There's some interesting things, dynamics that go into considering how social media consumes our lives, how we are present ourselves to society through that medium. And first of all, before we get into that, happy birthday. You had a birthday pretty recently.
Yeah, Monday, actually.
Monday, yeah.
The best day of the week to have a birthday.
Oh, wow, that is... That's the only cure for the case of the Mondays.
I know.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
Just real thrilled.
It's pretty exciting. So congratulations on being born and alive.
Thank you. I tried very hard.
Yeah, I know it was basically all, bootstraps effort that got you.
Mm-hmm. Born. There's a lot of breathing in the process, I've learned over the years.
It turns out there actually is, and
one warned me about that.
No one did warn you about that. They just expect you to.
Yeah.
It's pretty. Turns out to be pretty important.
Yeah. Go figure.
Breathing does. Yeah. I don't know. You learn a lot of things just through experience, I guess.
That's right.
So I guess we'll kind of go into the first topic, talking about social media in general and my personal history of social media use. I can think back to, I think we're relatively the same age, but I started out on livejournal.com. Yeah, my brother. I had an older brother who had a blog on LiveJournal. And so I was going to be cool, and I was going to... comment on all of his friends' blogs, and so I started my own, and I think I wrote a few posts, and then a couple of years later I looked back at those posts and I deleted them immediately because it was so embarrassing. I don't even remember.
That's smart.
I was maybe 13 or 14 at the time, and those opinions were not ready for the world.
I mean, you have to admit though, a 13-year-old can be pretty wise. You know so much at that age.
You do. You really have lived long enough to just understand all the perspectives and and nuance. That's pretty much when you're fully, your brain's fully developed, right? When you're 13.
Yeah. That's really when you peak, is at 13. Everything else is just...
Yeah.
I don't think I didn't do it right in life, but...
I may have peaked at 13.
With your live journal?
Yeah, with my live journal, because... So I moved on from live journal, and I got a Zynga, Zynga.com.
Does the story get better?
The story gets even better, or worse. But so Zynga was pretty exciting. And it was another blog. The only way that social media existed at first, as far as my experience was and we didn't even use the term social media, but... It was just, you know, blogs that you added your, well, from my experience, my brother's friends add, and eventually, like, well, because, you know, throw this bit of nuance in there, too. I was homeschooled, so it was mostly just youth group kids that I added, and we had, if you knew HTML code or had a friend that could figure that out, you could have a song playing in the background of your blog, and of course that was screamo era. So I had you know, if you were cool enough to have an Under Oath song, you had an Under Oath song while people were reading about what you ate that day. Mm-hmm. So
it's always great to have a live diary.
It is, especially when you're just experiencing things that you just have no idea how to describe what you're going through. Your emotions are a wreck. That is definitely when you should be just airing your most personal, private thoughts.
And it was any thought, really. I mean, those diaries, people wrote about everything that they did. There was very few guidelines to say, like, this is what you use it for. These are the types of conversations. It was like, whatever.
Right.
Who cares?
And it was brand new. It was brand new, and yeah, so no guidelines.
Platforms certainly didn't care about what age. Well, they claim to.
Technically, they said that you had to be, what was it, 13?
But it was like the Wild West, though.
But there were people, there were some kids on there younger than 13.
Yeah.
It was the Wild West. It was, and parents weren't on there yet. Parents being on social media is kind of a newer phenomenon. That skipped a generation.
That is a trend that tends to stay with popular social media platforms now.
Right. Which, I mean, that's that never sort of happened, so jump ahead to MySpace.com. That was the next one that I joined. And I joined it, and I felt cool, but then I realized that none of my friends on Zynga.com had switched, so... I was trying to convince people how great I was proselytizing MySpace so I could justify, I don't know, all the time I spent on it setting up a profile. But so then that slowly kind of took over, and it had a short reign, but it was a massive reign. That was really when things started exploding, and for me, it was the music part of it too. Was pretty big. The fact that it was where you went if you had a band, or some kind of musical side project. I think I had like 17 side projects on MySpace. each time I thought of a different name, I would start a band, and then I would say music coming soon. And I think on two of them, I actually uploaded something.
And everyone's still waiting for the rest of the music.
Yeah, I'm still working on it. To be honest.
Coming soon.
Right. Under construction. That was one of my favorite things to do online, was just to create a web page and say under construction, and use animated, early animated GIFs to show that. So MySpace lasted for a while. Were you on MySpace?
Were you
jumping in on that?
I probably shouldn't have, but I was.
You probably shouldn't have. That's definitely correct. Yeah. I can definitely say that. Did you get into any of that other blog stuff, the Zyngas or anything like that?
No, and that's probably good. I had no place sharing those ideas. It was all MySpace. I remember checking to see like how many friends pages. I was like on one of their top friends list. Like there was it like a list of 6 or 9 people that you could list as your top friends.
Yeah.
It was like an honor to be listed, and kind of seen as a way to showcase your popularity.
It was a
to
total
be listed
lifeboat.
On many people's top nine. Oh yeah.
It was a total just, all right, this is how we're, you know, where we just kind of talk mm-hmm. about it on the side. We're just going to broadcast it here on the very front of everyone's page.
Yeah.
How popular they are, how popular they want to be or perceive they are.
It was such a weird way for us to showcase our relationships and have to rank them.
Yeah, it was like, and we just kind of said, okay, this is how we decide.
Yeah, well, you could actually punish your friends in real life by doing mm-hmm. that. Like, you're no longer on my top list.
Right. You're okay, you're number six, but yes. if you piss me off, then I might just drop you and replace you with some new person that is going to be my friend or mm-hmm. is going to be my top friend. it was interesting dynamics for dating relationships too. That was that was problematic for a lot of people, I think, if they had to justify who was in the top spot if the romantic relationship was not there.
Mm-hmm.
What a world, basically.
Yeah.
And maybe some parents got on there, but I didn't really, you know, my life wasn't affected by that. Maybe like the cool parents.
Or the stalking, overbearing parents.
Right. Or the parents who were tech savvy enough on their Windows XP to set up their own account and realize that like it was actually something that people spent a lot of time mm-hmm. doing.
And I mean, we should acknowledge the dark side. I mean, there were creepers as well. Or that was a big fear for parents.
it was a big fear, and it was an even bigger unknown. You know, we're all pretty much aware of that now. But I think at the time there was, to use that phrase, the Wild West again.
Mm-hmm.
There was no sort of guidelines. There hadn't been enough Dateline episodes about it, so parents didn't feel adequately informed.
60 minutes.
There hadn't been
who your child is talking to.
right. There had only been like, not even a full 60 minutes episode, maybe like 10 minutes about just logging into the internet, maybe like what emails are your kids getting or something. It was very, they were very behind the times and sort of the traditional media.
But that's also not because they didn't only see it as an issue, but they also didn't have the language to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, when you have some new event and it kind of like that whole concept, language creates reality. It doesn't mm-hmm. exist as a problem until we have the language capable of describing it.
Right. And that's, language kind of shaping, as you said, reality, how we view things, mm-hmm. Kind of creating that shared meaning through how we talk about things. The relevance of social media today has a lot to do with terminology that, like you said, we didn't have when it first kind of showed up and, in the MySpace era and, kind of back in those days. I appreciate you tying that in. So in the earlier section of the podcast, which I'm going to be honest, I will record after this interview, we will have talked about social interaction theory mm-hmm. and so how shared meaning is created through interactions and a big part language. We kind of move into a sort of part of the history here where we hit the modern era of Facebook and Twitter and I remember first getting to college, and it was still, in 2006, it was mm-hmm. still college-only invite onto Facebook. Yeah. And
you'd have your college email to sign up for it.
Yeah, you had to have a college email. And I was told that it was, this was pretty important to do this. And so I did it, but I thought, well, I've got MySpace, so I'm not really going to need this.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, just sort of trying to fit in, but pretty skeptical. But Facebook has, and then it just over the years, it's really just lasted, I think, longer than we initially thought it would, and it's mm-hmm. become more things than we thought it would. It's kind of in this era of tech giants sort of taking over every sector of our lives.
But they've also been the most reactive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they study beyond their particular app. They evaluate human communication, and that's why they've been able to offer that. Not that they're, you know, flawless in any way.
Right. I mean, that they're an awareness of what they need to do to sort of maintain relevance and influence and mm-hmm. kind of affect you in these different parts of your lives. Facebook, they really sort of, created areas that, you had to use Facebook to log into these accounts, or really kind of created kind of social norms that Facebook could only really provide, as far as it became kind of a de facto way to sort of catch up with people that you knew, or that, that you kind of worked with, or mm-hmm. it's sort of and a lot of the new features that they've added, and just some of those other ways that it's evolved and sort of changed, and its influence has remained pretty much as strong as ever. I just mm-hmm. I remember the moment when my parents got on Facebook, and it was pretty much Armageddon. That had nothing to do. I mean, sure.
But our audiences were expanding. You have to adapt for a broader audience.
Yeah, and I was not. I did not feel ready to adapt. I felt maybe like that was my last refuge to sort of complain without censoring myself.
Your parents not going to be happy with some of the things you posted?
It was highly probable that they would question some of the things that I would post, in the days of Zynga and MySpace, and so. Mm-hmm. I had to adjust. That was before I was aware of the term rebranding, but I had to rebrand sort of my presence. And I have new people who opened up second Facebook accounts so they could continue their debaucherous ways without their mm-hmm. their family members knowing. We all just kind of got used to it, but it was just kind of a shock. But, ultimately it is because of that broadening of the audience, you not only have connecting with friends and coworkers, but like whole families can, I'm Facebook friends with family members that I've never met. Mm-hmm. Or at least I haven't seen since I was, pretty young, and this was probably the only way that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's been quite an evolution as far as just noticing, my own personal history of using these different websites, and how much of, our lives they've kind of carved a place out for. Mm-hmm. I didn't even get into Twitter, but.
Well, in social media, as it continues to evolve, like, we've always seen it like something separate, especially like when you think about Facebook, as you were saying, some people created separate profiles. It was something that we chose. We did something separate. We could really keep it very isolated. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's where we have, it's so easy to catfish people because of that.
Right.
But really what we're seeing that evolution today is that it's no longer like this separate thing. Like, I have my real life and I have my social life, but we're starting to see the merging of these two worlds, that we don't have separate lives, that what I do in my real life right. is immersed in social media. And I think about when learn things about my real life through social media and what other people do, and it's interactive and it becomes part of my real experiences, like taking selfies, live videos, doing Snapchat filters together, like all of that is a shared process. Even at live events, like conferences, everyone's using a hashtag as part of that integrated experience. It's no longer something separate that we go on later, at night and upload our favorite pictures of ourselves. We're doing it in the moment.
Right. That separate reality where you're kind of doing something on the side. It's like a kind of a side app or a side thing that you have. And it actually becomes like, how am I gonna present, I'm going to this conference, how am I going to maybe tell the world that I went to this conference or share my thoughts? It's mm-hmm. kind of an automatic, not even assumption, but reality is this is the best way I can do this, mm-hmm. to share this.
We've become adept at it. I mean, just like any other language we learn, we've people today, especially kids, are so socially adept at knowing how to use social media language. Like, that's just part of how it is. They aren't separate. That's how they talk in real life, and that's how they talk on social media. They right. think about it in those same terms.
Yeah, yeah, and it went from a place where it was separate to just kind of fused. And I remember the first time I heard someone actually say out loud #. Whatever, and my head exploded. I thought it was the most, just cheesy, ridiculous.
It still is.
It still is.
It definitely is.
Nothing can sort of replace the moment, the first moment that I heard that uttered from a human mouth. I was not prepared for that moment.
Well, now you've heard, like, there's a kid named # now.
Oh, no, I haven't heard that. But yeah,
so they get #.
#, okay, good.
Yeah.
That's great for him or her. That's
great life. Yeah. I don't know what that, yeah.
That's really, you're setting yourself up there for some, good things. I don't know.
We'll see.
We will see. Actually, we'll just, the future's ahead of #.
Maybe in 18 years we'll get an update that there was a name change.
Right. I wouldn't, maybe. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. We'll see. But so that just sort of that sort of change in how we talk and how we communicate was affected. And this is actually a pretty good segue into a question that I kind of was going to bring up was what can we sort of learn about our communication by our social media preference or presence, I should say. So it changes kind of the way that we communicate, and it's kind of fusing with the way that we, where it used to be we'd talk separately or we'd post separately or behave separately in these different corners. But now sort of how we present ourselves is kind of fusing with real life and it's becoming real life. And so that, I thought that'd be, something as far as from a perspective of how we communicate or the ways that we communicate. How has that evolved in kind of your perspective?
Sure. So that whole like identity management opportunity that we have, it gives us the chance to really control and be more deliberate in that process. There's very few times where you can accidentally post something. Like, you don't write a full post and then accidentally press send. Like, as you're writing it out, there's a chance that that's going to go out, sort of thing. So when we're creating things, like when we choose our profile picture, or even just choosing to create a social account, we're having an idea of how we want to interact with people. And with that purpose that we choose content, choose ways in which we can reveal ourselves to people. And that's much different than what we usually see in face-to-face context with social media. Now, granted, some of these mediums are becoming much more rich, especially when we have GIFs, we've got live video, we've got a million emojis now.
Replacing words with emojis. Yeah.
Yes. But even then, like, it's still removing some of the exact face-to-face feeling that we get of picking up on all of the nonverbals, of even getting that setting in there. It's pulling away those cues that we get. And that way we can then select which cues we are giving people, especially with social media as a whole. It tends to be more asynchronous still at this point. Mm-hmm. Even though there might be some live features, it's incredibly acceptable to have that delayed response. So that allows us to construct and not have silence be interpreted as awkwardness or something else. It could just be that we're not there. Now, that doesn't mean we always read it that way.
Right.
Like when someone doesn't respond to your text right away.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. And you can kind of see when someone's responding, there's kind of
those speakers off.
Oh, yeah. And
on LinkedIn, Facebook.
If you're savvy enough to do that, some people just don't go to that extra length to, I think, I remember.
But that's to show that I'm a high self-monitor. Like, I care how people perceive me and understand, and right. I put a lot of effort into my social media choices.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and I'll make sure that when people tag me in photos, I have to approve it first.
Oh, yeah. No, that was an important decision. I have some self-awareness in the sense that I realized at some point that I should probably make that distinction on my account. So yes. When someone tags me in some picture, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be of you for it to be, you know, controversial, you know, or problematic, or, you know, kind of you want to have some separation there so you can sort of. Because it is something that is still managed and still there's almost this expectation of managing in some way.
And most people do care about their presenting self.
Right. Most people do. I mean, and that's kind of the if they're just blanket critiques thrown out at the medium in general, or even just more broadly speaking of millennials. You know, as a generation, because millennials are what I'm told are the only ones who use social media. But it just kind of the whole narcissism thing, the whole being in a sort of communicating in a way where it's kind of about presenting, you know, your best version of yourself all the time, and you know, just kind of these sort of perceptions that if you are constantly logging into an account and contributing to this account where it's just kind of about you and kind of starting from there. And I think that was definitely true of the sort of MySpace type situation. But in to a certain extent, Facebook and Twitter, but they've also kind of, you know, with the kind of invention of a news feed and kind of the algorithms that kind of sort of bring the content of your friends out and show you that, I think that's changed that a little bit, or at least taken maybe a bit of that away.
It's also adapted the way we can engage in social comparison. Mm-hmm. Just the amount of data, and also what kind of data that we can see from people. In face-to-face or in social engagements that we have, we see them kind of, not to sound like documentarian, but in their natural habitat, you know, interacting, reacting in real time sort of thing. More imperfections are more likely to show, because it's harder in face-to-face to control every, you know, nonverbal that we can offer, to control anything that impacts us. So we're more likely to be revealing in those situations. Right. But on social media, when we're looking at different pictures of other people, it's so constructed, and it gives us this distorted view of how other people really are.
Right. Now, I mean, everyone can kind of play their cards close to their hand, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Now, granted, I think that was still more of the earlier stage in social media where we only saw that. But as society as a whole has kind of embraced this love yourself, love your body, you don't have to be perfect concept. We're seeing that reflected on social media, and social media has advanced that thought process even more. Yeah. You know, you see Instagrammers who are like fitness gurus, and they'll show like they're not just before and after, but even like when they're sitting, you know, they still don't have perfect abs when they're sitting, because you know what, it's appropriate to have, you know, certain fat on you, or everybody to a certain degree always has double chins on there.
Right.
And you see people opening up about mental illness and when they're struggling or when things aren't going well. There's been this emergence of wanting to be genuine.
Yeah, and so there's almost, and that's a kind of interesting thought to sort of entertain there, is that sort of, how new is that? Is that something that's sort of changing and more recent? Because, you know, there's that social comparison sort of dilemma the theory that kind of creates the dilemma that we kind of referenced of, you know, when the likes aren't there, you're sort of so there, on the one hand, there's kind of they really liked, you know, all these things, and but I post this and people don't like that, and then so there's sort of that sort of You know, you get a certain amount of dopamine, positive sort of confirmation when you post something that gets likes, but when you post something that doesn't, you know, then there's sort of a, you know, what happened? Why is, I guess, mm-hmm. people don't like me when I'm like that. And so, so our tendency, but the depression and anxiety that kind of have been observed to kind of come from our tendency to compare mm-hmm. ourselves with other people.
Yeah.
So
there, as we learn more about social media and as the platforms, and that's one of the things that I think Facebook has done well, is that they're trying to communicate more about those experiences mm-hmm. and how to interpret them. So when we say, like, yeah, we count how many likes we get, but really, what is a like? How meaningful is a like these days? Think about when you go on Facebook or Twitter, how many things do you like, and how many of those do you really actually engage in? Do you just read it and, you know, out of social obligation, you like it? Because, you know, it's right. your pastor, and you're like, of course I like what my pastor says.
Well, yeah, as my pastor, if I don't like yeah. that, I'm sinning.
They say wonderful things all the time. Right. you know, there's a commitment and an expectation that we have to go through, and we have to like these. Facebook is now starting to punish those posts a little bit more. Well, maybe not punish, but they're starting to favor posts that get more comments. Mm-hmm. You know, having a lot of likes doesn't matter. What they want to see is, are you prompting discussion?
Are you engaging is kind of how they're yes. changing.
And we're starting to understand that those are also shallow metrics. Just because mm-hmm. you're getting likes, what does that mean? So, for example, my husband, I'm going to use him as an example. He may not appreciate
nice.
That.
Even if he doesn't, I approve.
Yeah. So, I mean, he tweeted out a video that he clipped from him playing Sea of Thieves on its beta. And he tweeted it out, Sea of Thieves, retweeted on their account, and he got over, like, 2,000 views on the video.
Okay.
Hundreds of likes. Like, it was amazing for him.
Wow,
and
yeah.
he thought, this will be great. Since I tweeted this out, I'm getting a lot of viewers. A bunch of people are liking it. I'm going to get new followers on Twitch, which is ultimately what he's yep. trying to do. About out of those hundreds of people that liked it, and out of those 2,000 plus views that he got on there, only 21 people actually clicked through to his profile.
Uh-huh.
And since that time, since he's posted it, he's had zero new followers.
And
which kind of takes it, maybe they saw his face and go, nah, I don't want to follow this guy.
That can't be it. I'm trying to imagine all the possible scenarios, and I know they didn't see his face. But the engagement thing is pretty interesting. Just the sort of, if you get so many likes, or if you, you know, impressions, I guess, is another way mm-hmm. to sort of, people who saw it and then didn't click through. It's almost kind of, you know, we talk about being shallow, but it's almost sort of a rejection that
yeah.
I didn't like it enough to actually spend some time on it. You know, it's almost like, all right, I guess I'll just like this, or maybe I won't. But you know, so it's really kind of interesting how you know, that difference that we're sort of, and these are things that we're more aware of now, I think. Because mm-hmm. initially we sort of, you know, saw that as, and maybe some still do, of, you know, a like is you like me, or you endorse what I'm saying, or, mm-hmm. you know, and they kind of change it now so you can, like, react, you know, haha, or I'm mm-hmm. angry about this. And because, you know, if someone posts that, you know, the funeral is this Saturday and people like it, that's kind of a bit
yeah.
odd.
It's good yeah. that Facebook has offered those new emotional reactions for
right,
us. And even
right.
then, it still feels limiting.
It does. Well, even it still feels pretty, you know, like that's the least you can do.
Yeah.
About the possible scenarios of using that.
But I do have to, I think on Facebook's side, they've done a good choice of not providing metrics like that. Like, all you see is really just those shallow ones that you don't see how many impressions you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't, to a certain degree, you can be too wrapped up in it. But that's not unique to social media. I mean, in any
right.
situation, someone can care too much about how other people are viewing them and get anxiety about that. Social media, though, just puts a numerical value to it.
Right.
You know, Facebook has avoided providing that to people. But Twitter, you know, on your personal account, you can go to analytics.twitter.com mm-hmm. and see it. LinkedIn has just started giving you that as well. You can see who's checked out your profile, how many people have seen your post.
Yeah. Well,
LinkedIn is stressful.
LinkedIn has gotten kind of obnoxious. I don't know your feelings on LinkedIn, but I all of a sudden, for a while, you know, I sort of left it alone and I came back and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden it was every, you know, maybe I downloaded the app again or something, but I was getting notifications from LinkedIn on the hour, and I would check the notification and it would be, maybe, you know, it would open up all these different types of notifications that you could receive. Like maybe someone was browsing something over there and we thought you should read mm-hmm. that. But also people viewed your profile and kind of created a new form of paranoia. Like, okay, yeah. People are viewing my profile. This is it.
You know, and why? And what are they looking for?
Right.
Who are they?
Am I about to get hired? Am I about to get fired? Is someone stalking me?
Somebody's been talking about me. How'd they find me?
Right. Yeah. There's some process led to them searching my name. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. It's almost the idea of maybe too much information or too much awareness mm-hmm. of how people are interacting with your
and on your profile. Your it profile. Shows like everything that you've liked too.
Oh, it's, yeah.
I hate that. Yeah,
that's extremely too much.
They're going through puberty right now. They're trying to find themselves. What works? What doesn't work?
Yeah. Yeah.
Facebook is about in their 30s at this point. Like uh-huh. they figured out like, oh, we do really well with like creating close relationships. We don't need relationships with everyone. So they're kind of honing in on their skill set at that point. Like
right.
we tested out, this is what we're going to go with. We're going to go in that direction. And they've chosen it. Twitter's in between in that middle age.
Yeah, no, Twitter is, Twitter's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Mm-hmm.
But I would say Snapchat has probably aged the quickest. I think direction-wise, right. they have paid attention to that. You know how earlier we talked about social media not being something separate anymore? Mm-hmm. Snapchat came in really at that time where we started to see that barrier disappear. Like they gave out very little instructions, like actually how to use the app, because they knew in face-to-face interactions, you would explain it to other people mm-hmm. and then you would spread it word of mouth. So they knew Snapchat is going to grow based upon in real face-to-face interactions.
Right.
Because that barrier doesn't exist. Facebook grew and got its mass numbers because of the way it connected separately. It was a much more isolated experience. Like we chose to do that. You might have right. one person, like one friend who forced you to sign up, who's there helping you fill it out. Mm-hmm. But Snapchat is meant to be social.
Yeah. And it forces the issue and sort of the, that is a good point, the lack of sort of instructions. It's a very basic platform mm-hmm. and they didn't really say much about it. You know, it's kind of a funny thing, and it's not something that a lot of people are utilizing it that maybe earlier on than we I would have expected. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of family members and stuff like that kind of skipped. Yeah, as you said, it was aging quicker, I guess. But
mm-hmm. Just because they figured out what they want to do.
Right. It's almost that we've kind of gotten past the era of that's like a secret or that's, mm-hmm. you know, they've quantified that a bit more as yeah. to what they can get.
Now as a business, they haven't quite figured out how to make money, but that's a separate topic.
Well, I mean, yeah, I understand that problem. So it's kind of interesting. I'll be remiss not to talk about sort of the ways in which the other side of the social comparison theory leading towards I was kind of reading kind of just an old article, just sort of they've done numerous studies on sort of how depression is affected by mm-hmm. Comparing yourself and by seeing people presenting their most successful selves there was this kind of sense that maybe upward comparisons, you know, this person is having a more successful life than me, mm-hmm. is creating this depression. Whereas, you know, downward, I feel better. Maybe there's that kind of boosting your ego by comparing, you know, to people who maybe are having who are airing their dirty laundry and it's really bad. Mm-hmm. At least I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
Well,
isn't that why we add our old high school buddies?
That's exactly why you remain friends with a lot of people that you could have just filtered out because,
yep.
you know, despite all of the terrible things that they post or repost, you know, But they, so the study that more recently kind of found that whether it's upward or downward or even sort of neutral comparison socially, that they all linked to a kind of greater likelihood for depressive symptoms. You know, kind of the idea of sort of comparison just in general as sort of if you're feeling kind of isolated and separate and you're not interacting and engaging, but you're comparing, like that contributes to depression. And and I think that, and where you kind of mentioned how as a platform, it's trying to move toward actually engaging people, sort of making it more interactive. I kind of, you know, kind of think they're responding to some of that information and maybe sort of trying to adjust for that. And you know, do you feel like that's that they'll be successful in doing that?
I do. I think there's some platforms that naturally do that better, and it tends to be platforms that have fewer cues on them, where it is more discussion based. Now, granted, you can still, people are still bullies in certain areas. Some people are just awful trolls that we have. But I think when you have more text based messages only, you don't get as much of that comparison.
Right.
Just because there's fewer cues for us to pull up on and to compare. There's less data, essentially, for us to have that analysis to have. But when you get into more ones that are richer, of course, like Facebook, Instagram, and well, I say Facebook and Instagram, Facebook owns Instagram.
Right,
I think of course, there is a financial reason for them to do this, to be socially responsible. But they recognize that it's their responsibility to take care of their consumers, to create it as a place that they want to continue to go back to and create experiences there. So yeah, they're trying to adapt the way that they send messages. Now, they don't do a great job of monitoring it. Twitter has tried, and that has been, well, you've probably heard the criticisms of Twitter trying to monitor these spaces for us. But it also takes, that's where we're kind of going back to that social integration, where it takes other people to fill in and help explain and to reassure what they're seeing, to be real with one another. And that also comes with, I think, I feel like I'm tying a lot of things in that we said earlier, but
no,
the
good
societal awareness of like mental illness,
right,
and our willingness to talk about it. If we weren't willing, there's still a stigma, of course, with it, but if we were to compare like where it was 20 years ago, Facebook may not have felt the need to do anything about it, that it's still
right,
something that we don't talk about or address. It isn't an issue for us, but as we're seeing this effect from Facebook, we're becoming more aware, we're seeing these issues, and it's happening because it's on a social and public area that we can document. Face-to-face, it's hard to document. Nobody walks around automatically, well, some people, YouTubers, walk around recording all the time, but most people don't. And so those situations, because they weren't documented, they're harder to kind of communicate on a mass level of identifying problems and that we all need to talk about it. But on social media, that's documented. Even on private networks, you know, always pretend that it's public.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's what I always instruct.
That's sort of like the cautionary advice that you receive never just always assume that, you know, anything you post online is not private. And, you know, that's, you know, how concerned are we really with privacy at this point? is posting on social media, is there still a sense that it's surrendering your right to privacy? I think my Instagram account name is actually Nate and his lack of privacy, because just to kind of, there was this big freak out moment where, we can use your content in our ads, and there was this huge outcry, and people were all going to quit, and you know, it was another situation where everyone was going to quit a certain social media platform that they didn't.
Right.
And you know, I think just the good general rule to kind of guide you in that is, if a service is free, then you are the product. And it shouldn't really be a surprise that If you send a message or you upload something, that they own that content. You didn't pay them to say, I'm just going to, you know, secretly store this and you can never use it. You sign these agreements and they, that you give
even
them
if you
permission.
Didn't read them.
You didn't read them. No one's ever read them. No.
No.
If you have, then that is actually a mental health diagnosis.
If you have, you're probably not on that platform.
Right. Exactly.
You'd opt out. And I'm not surprised. We were talking about how Facebook is helping. Facebook can track so much that I wouldn't be surprised if they are able to start not diagnosing, but keeping track and looking for cues that might be harmful. You know, there's any text analysis that they can have, image analysis. They're paying attention to how long you stay on different pages, the comments that you provide, the things you choose to click on, how often you go back and check at different pages, how often that person's going back and interacting with you. So they're able to engage how much you're interacting with others and how others are interacting with you and over what. Not that they would share that data, right?
Of course not. Yeah.
Just because they have it doesn't mean that they're actively putting it to use. But
if I sent you a direct message and that is private information, that's never going to get out, ever.
Right. You know, like when I message my husband what I want for Christmas, it's amazing that on his ads the next day there's that item while he's scrolling Facebook.
Yeah, there's some dark magic that just knows. Mm-hmm. We tend to think it's it's like maybe Siri's just I left Siri on or it's there's a microphone listening on, and it really doesn't even need that. It's just you just normally using your content, you tend to talk about things that you're interested in.
We better be careful. We're going to get into an episode of Black Mirror now.
Right. I think we already kind of are. So yeah.
But I think going back to that, kind of pulling in that concept of how we create our identity on there, and even on the concept of depression and it being difficult, if it's still interactive of or reflective of how your actual social or face-to-face experiences are. I don't want to say your real experiences, because we know social media experiences are real experiences. You know, they're not something separate. It's not that we have, you know, these fake social media emotions that we get from it that are separate, that only exist on that platform. It's still seeing all of that. Now, certain triggers can occur in that place, but it's knowing that this is still a holistic way, and that building relationships as a whole, whether that's on social media, whether that's in face-to-face, is still important, that we're pulling that in and using all of that to impact our identity.
Right.
Hopefully.
And I kind of think of, I sort of think of using, I had a thought and I lost it, but wow, there it goes. Life comes at you fast.
Yeah. But it's learning that, and, you know, even at the beginning we were saying, well, people, you don't learn these things. You don't learn to breathe. Nowadays, it's important that we are taught.
Right.
Like when you're growing up, here's what you look at on social media. Here's what you don't look at on social media. Like there takes that instruction. Just like if, you know, before social media, like don't listen to those kids when they make fun of you, or that doesn't matter, or it doesn't, you know, don't care about those things. We had to have that instruction beforehand, and we'll still need it on social media.
Right. And it's just kind of learning just sort of how to socialize and through kind of if we just kind of fall back into that symbolic interactionism sort of theory and just kind of learning, ascribing meaning through our interactions with each other, and also through the ways that we communicate and social media as being that sort of integral part of it, to where you almost don't even need to distinguish that something is social media anymore. It's just communication. And so with that sort of happening, we kind of learn to see the world through that lens, and it's hard to kind of imagine it through other means.
Mm-hmm. And let's be real on the concept of constructed, because sometimes it may seem bad that on social media that we manipulate ourselves, like we create a face that we have. whether it's on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, which for me, if you find me on any of those platforms, I look differently on all of them.
Yeah, Present yourself differently with each one.
Yes. Yeah. The pictures I choose, the content that I talk about, the people I connect with, all of them have different audiences that I'm comparing and engaging with, that I'm sharing different information with, that I want them, and I do, I want them to see me in a particular way that's different. That's why there's some people I don't connect with on all of the platforms. I just connect with them on that particular platform because I only want them to see me in that particular way.
Right.
But that's not different from face to face. You know, people think that manipulation is not good, but we manipulate all the time. It's us being purposeful of how we create that. Like when you go to work versus when you talk to your family, you know, those are still situations. Platforms are now just those situations on a digital sense in which we have these settings and contexts that we adapt who we are, the way we talk, what we wear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't like to think of ourselves as sort of presenting ourselves differently, but you're not really being honest if you deceive yourself into thinking that you talk to, maybe you do talk to your boss the same way you do, like your significant other, and that may be a problem, but...
That may not be healthy. That's another topic.
Some professional boundaries is definitely an episode that that we can get into, but so those things that you do, those sort of conventions, those social conventions that you have that are used as critiques against sort of expressing yourself on these different mediums, it's not really all that different than how you behave outside of that. I think of people in my life that I've always kind of had this thought, like, man, if I was a minimalist, I would be so much happier. If I just gave up everything, and that's a function of my kind of state of anxiety and just sort of dealing with that, and just thinking like I could just throw everything away, and then that'll solve all my problems. I won't have student loan debt anymore. It'll be fine. It'll be great.
Go live off the grid.
Yeah, I'll just go off the grid, and they'll never find me. And there's kind of that. I do kind of run into that romanticizing sort of, this isn't a direct sort of bashing minimalism segment, but I have these friends or these people I know that have no social media preference whatsoever or presence. I keep mixing those two words up, but so they don't have a account on anything. And it's kind of almost noteworthy that they don't. Like, their spouses may post, like, and to, you know, on their behalf or let you know that they exist. But then you realize, oh, yeah, they're not on social media at all. And me being sort of that tendency to sort of glorify minimalism as, like, the magic solution to all my anxiety, I think, wow, what if I just got off of everything? I deleted my Facebook account. I deleted my Twitter account. I closed all these accounts and I just lived off the land.
Farmer Nate.
Right. Yeah. I could just get a farm and that would be different than being on social media somehow. But I had this sort of fantasy, kind of weird sort of what if I just left it all and got off the grid kind of thought. But but that's not really going to... because of the way and the kind of the things you've brought up about how we communicate a lot of the same ways through those mediums as we would face to face and on the phone or in any other sort of method of communication that we also have. These services are designed in such a way that they've kind of adjusted for all these different variables, and so it's a bit more there's not really this anything that's added to the equation that you don't already add in other areas of your life or subtract from. And also, it's apparently impossible to fully delete Facebook anyway, so if you've already posted a lot of information on there, it's not like that just goes away.
It's just archived.
Right. It's in the archives, which you know, probably doesn't even matter, but you know, if you're already paranoid.
Same with Snapchat, though.
Yeah,
well, right. You know, if you ever do anything wrong, Anonymous will find you through those archives.
Yeah, they'll hunt you down. It's
yeah,
and really, that's, you know, so there's that paranoia too. Although you'd be surprised some of the stuff you hear about people thinking they can, you know, get away with, and just thinking that it's this private thing. They do like expose, or you hear about these like documentaries that they do of, did you know that if you posted a picture but kept it as private, then they could potentially find you if you were a criminal? It's like, makes sense, you know, kind of the earlier point of, you know, if a service is free, then, you know, like, you're the product, and, mm-hmm. and they, if they own the service that you're uploading things onto, and you agree mm-hmm. that you providing them content is theirs once you post it there.
And also how much you trust your audience.
Right. And how much you trust your audience or
mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many people who've like screenshotted and, you know, share with employers. Hey, they've been sharing this, have reported to police. I mean, even sharing to their parents. You know, people will call, you know, their siblings out for that.
Yeah, which
at varying degrees.
Yeah, which that can rock someone's world too.
Yeah, but I mean, that's it's about when we showcase an identity, allowing others to interact with that identity.
Right.
Because social media, you're reaching that point where we're saying yes. We create these private, separate selves that we can identify. But even when we are directly interacting with particular individuals where we want them to see a particular side of us, and maybe within that audience that we've curated on our own, they accept that identity that we have, who we are. But when it gets exposed, because social media is always public or has the capability of being public,
right.
Does that identity we create resonate well and is accepted and confirmed by the larger audience?
Right. And it's what you do with it. It's a resource that's there. And mm-hmm. it's a way to sort of adjust how you, can relate to people, how you can communicate with people. And, you know, it's just, it's not going to kind of go away. It might adjust and mm-hmm. develop, but it's, you know, I consider going off the grid, I think, well, it's inevitable, so I'm just gonna stick around and see how things play out. But I appreciate we've been kind of going at this for about an hour or so. That's yeah. pretty good. It's a bit past the 10-minute mark, so I think so
not I'm not good at counting, but I think you're right.
Right. Yeah. No. I think. I think I see it on my Skype call. So, so good job. Yay.
We did it.
successfully talked about things. I appreciate you coming on, and this was all really good stuff. Sharing your insights and sort of exploring kind of the inevitability of all this, but also the fact that just because something's inevitable or it's changed how we do things, or it's something that we initially didn't really understand very well, it's actually become a potentially pretty beneficial part of kind of assisting us in our communication or sort of helping us understand more about ourselves and the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Any kind of parting thoughts?
I mean, it's just like any other reality. So as we influence reality and reality influences us, that's the same with social media. We're not victims of social media, especially since these platforms are created by people. Give your feedback, change the way you're talking and engaging with people. You get to dictate that process. You have more control than you think. You know, platforms aren't areas where we're victims. We can be active users in how we define ourselves and how we encourage others to identify and define themselves.
Right. There you go. You've officially been coached on how to engage on a social media.
You're empowered.
You are empowered. That's even better than coached.
You can do
coached.
It all. Yeah. You're now a god on social media.
Uh-huh. Yep. You are an empowered millennial. or maybe you're not a millennial. I don't know.
Yeah, Gen Xer, Gen Y.
Maybe you're a Gen
baby
Y-er.
Boomer.
Maybe you're a baby boomer.
Have you heard there's a small section like the microbrewers?
The microbrewers. Oh, wow. Super jealous of that generation based on that information alone.
I know.
That's pretty wonderful. Wow. Mm-hmm. So, Becca, before I let you go, there is a kind of way that I end these shows. That's kind of an authoritarian sort of mandate that we at least consider or think about coping skills. It's mandatory coping skills is the policy.
Okay.
Yeah. Since this is a social science based sort of perspective podcast and we talk about some things that surprisingly. Who would have thought that would have come up in any way? I was never... You know, I totally did not know that. But so just sort of interacting with the news and interacting with maybe parts of our lives and the things that can be, you know, stressful or burdensome, having a coping skill, which is just kind of another way of saying things that I do that I enjoy that sort of help me get by or help me manage or help boost my mood a little bit or... you know, whatever it is, there's a variety of ways in which we cope throughout the day. So I'm making it a habit of mandating that I put my guests on the spot and just sort of ask, how do you get through the day? What are your coping skills?
Sure. Well, I can give you probably some of the basic ones that people do, like go for a walk, running, you know, breathing exercises, whatever that fun stuff is. And I do all that, but since I'm kind of social media focused, I'll give you one of my social media breaks. So I have a Twitter list that's private and it's just called Happy Thoughts.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's all the accounts that make me happy. And they're mainly consistent of like dog accounts that I follow, lots of dogs and dog rates. If you don't follow them, you should. The only one that's not an animal-based account is actually The Rock, Dwayne Rock Johnson.
Yes.
That man is the most positive human being out there. But it's purposely making sure that you're integrating content into your life, sources into your life that provide that release for you. You know, so it's not accidental that I stumble across it. I purposely made a list that when I need it, I've got it there.
You baked it into your own cake.
Yes. Yes.
If you're going to, you know, maybe try to make that sort of phrase work. But all right. So mandatory coping skills. I'm going to just take a moment and ask that everyone just go into your Twitter accounts and create a list or... what would they be the equivalent, I guess, on Facebook or someplace else? I'm drawing a blank.
You can create a group. You can create lists on Facebook as well. Typically, that's used as you create, like, when you're posting content, like, who can see it sort of thing. But you can auto-select that for your news feed, too.
Oh, fair enough. So either of those ways, or in a more creative or different way, or maybe just send yourself a private message of, something, but whatever you do, just go ahead and, if you're listening, just, take some time and, subscribe or add some pictures of dogs or cats or, The Rock.
Yes, he is beautiful.
Yeah. So that is true. I can't really. I was trying to walk away from that, but I couldn't.
No.
I ran into something while I was staring.
We addressed the tough issues.
Yeah. This is, you know, he could.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. To be honest, but you know, it's cute.
He's
animals
so strong physically,
are
mentally,
strong
and emotionally.
Physically, mentally, and most emotionally. People. Whatever it is that you need to add into that sort of coping skills package that you have, that list to reinforce positive thoughts in your kind of social media interactions in your life, go ahead and do that, and your days will be uplifted to some mm-hmm. degree, hopefully.
Yeah.
If you do it right.
Hopefully. And it's just making sure you use social media that it benefits you.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Thanks for entertaining and surviving and getting through the mandatory coping skills.
Yeah. And I remembered to breathe the entire time.
And you were breathing. And you were thinking about breathing.
Yeah. Occasionally.
Yeah.
I found myself holding my breath sometimes. So, yeah, there's some thought process.
Right. Yeah. The last one of these that we did, we did sort of do a visualization and a breathing exercise. And I got really into it. And then I kind of lost track that we were recording a podcast. I just realized that I was just breathing and I was recording that and I was planning on sending that out as content. And I did. And I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. Everyone just breathe with you. Though breathing, surprisingly, is something that some people need to be taught. I had a friend, she's in her over 30s, and her doctor just let her know that she's been breathing wrong her entire life.
You hate to get that news, that something so crucial and important you've been doing wrong your entire life.
That was an actual diagnosis for her.
Yeah. Which, so mm-hmm. wonderful. So, wonderful. Don't forget to breathe.
Here's an extra tip. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck, people.
Breathing is important. Becca Godsey, social media lead and also a communication instructor mm-hmm. at Southwest Baptist University.
That's also my Twitter handle. Becca Godsey.
Oh, okay.
At Southwest Baptist University.
I thought you were going to say communication instructor at Southwest Baptist University. I did not think you could use that many characters.
It's longer now.
Yeah, no. They did expand that. That's there's other possibilities. There's other topics. How about I'll bring you back on sometime. I feel like there's more to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
Awesome. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me. And we're going underground. Hey!